What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and this is Pacific Review, where we'll be taking a look at our top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, Papua New Guinea and Australia sign off on a new defense treaty, Tonga's politicians gear up for next month's election, and Fiji Rugby blocks its players from taking part in the breakaway R360 competition. We'll have more on those stories coming up. Pacific Review comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. They're called narco subs, semi-submersibles used by South American cartels to smuggle drugs across international borders. But their mysterious appearance in the Pacific, minus their cargo and crew, is sparking concerns about the level of drug trafficking taking place in the region. The ABC's Chris and Rita Omanu-Leong reports on this week's discovery of the third such vessel in Solomon waters.
Robinson Fugui and his cousin were travelling by boat to the Saturday market in Solomon Islands, Malaita province, when they spotted something strange bobbing in the water. It was unlike anything they'd ever seen before.
So me back frightful.
I was frightened. It was my first time to see this kind of boat. We didn't know what it was. I told my cousin, don't go in yet, in case there's someone inside.
What they found was a narco sub, a semi-submersible vessel that's used by international drug cartels to smuggle narcotics across international borders. There was no trace of its cargo or crew, so the cousins towed the empty 17-meter-long vessel back to their village. The only clue to its origins? An imprint on a pipe with the words, Colombia 2024.
The police came and they saw everything. All the pipes connected to the engine, they were Colombian. They had written on them, made in Colombia 2024.
Abandoned narco subs have washed up in different parts of the world, including in French Polynesia. In Solomon Islands, Robinson's discovery isn't an isolated case. It's the third time in the past year alone for a vessel to be discovered. All three had no drugs on board, and police say they're investigating. But experts say the discoveries further highlight how drug cartels are using the sparse and largely unpoliced Pacific Islands as a transit point onto the more lucrative Australian market. It's a worrying situation for Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele.
We are aware, I'm aware of the challenges posed by drugs, illicit drugs in our country. I've been informed by our Commissioner of Police on those incidences.
Steward Tonawane is a Solomon Islands prosecutor. He says it's likely the drugs were transferred in the high seas. He says these cases show planning and sophistication.
The capacity they have, they have used sophisticated equipment and they have used strong intel and they have gone through certain level of research to see how and what needs to be done.
He says the challenge for Solomon Islands and Pacific nations is to maintain a strong level of surveillance. But until then, the police force is calling on Solomon Islanders to remain vigilant and report any narco sub sightings. As for this narco sub, Robinson is staking his claim.
If I find these things that no one owns, then it obviously means I'm the new owner.
And that was Robinson Fugui ending that report from Chris and Rita Omanu-Leong in Solomon Islands. The Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, James Marape, says the signing of a new defence treaty with Australia is part of a natural progression. He says it's a landmark in terms of relationships that has developed between the two countries since PNG achieved independence. Under the terms of the new deal, up to 10,000 personnel from the PNG Defence Force could be recruited by the ADF. But Mr. Marape says that number could easily rise.
If Australia needs personnel to be recruited, Papua New Guinea has a youthful population, most of them complete grade 12 and subject to the due processes. Papua New Guineans can be enlisted into Australian Defence Force. They will not be reporting to the PNG Defence Force commander. They will be Australian Defence Force personnel. Of course, in PNG ourselves, it is in our interest to build a Defence Force to a 7,000-man force that is strong in our land, sea and air capacities.
Did Chinese officials make any direct or indirect threats as to the consequences if you signed this treaty with Australia?
Not at all, and I want to commend Chinese who gave us full respect to our sovereign interests. And they understand very clearly where we've come from. In 1975, prior to September 16, we were part of the Australian sovereignty. Our shared history speaks volume, and so they clearly understand where we are going, and we've been transparent to not just Chinese, but all nations we have foreign relationship with or security relationship with.
Now, this agreement clearly serves Australia's military interests that, as we know, are explicitly focused on the threat from China. How does that serve PNG's interests?
PNG's interests come in the range of spin-offs that comes under the umbrella of this treaty. Not just the hands and boots and uniforms conversation, but the military hardwares, the military softwares. So there's a range of benefits that PNG Defence Force gets as a result of this.
But presumably, Prime Minister, you could get all of those benefits from the defence arrangements that you already had. This treaty is different because it commits you to act in the face of a common danger. That's the question. That's clearly in Australia's interest because PNG provides a useful geographic location as well as all the other benefits. But what does PNG get from Australia's interest vis-a-vis a heavily militarising China?
As I said earlier, PNG stands beneficial to the capacity built of our own defence force. The construct of this treaty is a construct in peacetime for peace. This is not a construct to create war. It is rather a construct to establish peace.
And yet, at the same time, the Australian Defence Review, Strategic Review, recently made absolutely clear and explicit that it was being put together with an eye to the rapid militarisation of the Chinese military. Do you see the militarisation of China in the same way as Australia does?
It's a nation, whether it's Australia or China or any nation for that matter, have their own strategic views in terms of their military. And it's entirely up to China or Australia to build up their defence force.
Except that now you're involved in a mutual defence treaty where you would join Australia if it came under attack.
There is a provision in the agreement that whenever attacks does take place, if it does happen, and there is ability for PNG Defence Force Commander and Australia Defence Force Commander to engage in making critical military decisions at that point in time.
So you are not actually necessarily committing to join a conflict with China that Australia was involved in?
What does PNG have to offer right now? That's a question I would be letting my country know. At the moment, our military capacity is not at a space where we are an active participant. We are a contributor to a subject a conflict. And so it is in our interest to work to build. And I don't necessarily see China as an enemy. China is a good relationship nation, even with Australia, with PNG. We trade with China. We do business with China. And so there's no need for an alarmist approach in this conversation.
But if it's a realistic question as opposed to an alarmist one, obviously the Australian Defence Force, the Australian Defence Establishment has considered the possibility of war with China. We know the Americans have considered that possibility. So what does PNG do in those circumstances?
I don't have the mindset of Australian Defence Force to speak for the Australian Defence Force.
But the question is actually what PNG would do in those circumstances. Let me put it like this, Prime Minister. Is it possible that PNG could make a decision not to be involved in a conflict Australia was engaged in with China?
There's a high possibility when an event happens. PNG has a sovereign in itself. This construct of treaty was constructed within the fullest ambit of respecting sovereignties in making their own calls.
So if you sign a treaty that talks about facing a common danger, what a common danger is?
Likewise, Australia, PNG was engaged in a construct. We would not expect in a conflict. We don't expect Australia to drop everything else and run to us. The treaty has provisions where there'll be consultations, there'll be engaged. There's a finality of making call that rests with respective Defence Force commanders.
And that was Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister, James Marape, speaking there to the ABC's Sarah Ferguson. You're listening to Pacific Review. I am Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company as we go through the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Amnesty International says New Zealand should open up migration pathways to Pacific Islanders most at risk from the impacts of climate change. The Human Rights Watchdog has criticized New Zealand's Pacific visa regime, which is open to people from Tuvalu and Kiribati, saying it's discriminatory and out of date. The ABC's Liam Fox with this report.
Under New Zealand's Pacific Access Category Resident Visa, or PAC for short, people from Tonga, Fiji, Kiribati and Tuvalu can register for an annual ballot and, if selected, then apply for residence. This year's ballot had 250 places for Tongan citizens, the same number for Fijians, and 75 places each for Kiribati and Tuvalu. But Nicola Delvino, Amnesty International's researcher on refugees and migrant rights, says the conditions applicants must meet are restrictive and discriminatory.
We found that this visa, although it has represented a lifeline for some Tuvaluans and Kiribati, is not in line with international human rights law because it is a visa that discriminates against people with disabilities, people with medical conditions, older people.
In a new report, Amnesty International says New Zealand's Pacific visa is discriminatory because of its age limit. Only people aged between 18 and 45 can apply for themselves and their family, and it's a requirement that all applicants be in good health. Mr. Delvino says this means people with health conditions and disabilities are effectively excluded, and as a result, families have been broken up to allow some members to go to New Zealand while others remain behind.
I can give the case of Alieta, that's not her real name. She is a mother and a teacher from Tuvalu, and she has a visual impairment. She had a six-year-old daughter and husband when they applied for PAC, while the husband and the six-year-old girl could leave for New Zealand, she had to remove her name from the application. This was back in 2016. Alieta then tried several times to apply for a visa, including short-term visas, but she never managed to get a positive response from New Zealand. That means that since 2016, this mother has not been able to travel to Aotearoa, New Zealand to see her daughter.
Amnesty's Pacific researcher Kate Schutze says the impact of the visa restrictions are compounded for those from the low-lying atoll nations of Tuvalu and Kiribati.
The migration policies haven't been updated to reflect the realities of the climate crisis in Kiribati and Tuvalu. So we found that the people most impacted by the climate crisis, which are people with disabilities, older people, people with medical conditions, but not only those people, are obviously more impacted back home when the sea levels rise and they can't access clean drinking water, and food security is becoming an increasing problem as well.
The New Zealand government says Pacific visas recognise the country's long-standing relationship with the region. In a statement, Sam Foley, manager of immigration policy, says they're not aimed at addressing people movement caused by climate change. Regarding the good health and other requirements, he says they apply across all residence visa categories and are designed to support people to successfully settle here and support themselves and their families. Mr. Foley says where a family member does not meet the health requirement, medical waivers can be sought in defined circumstances. Amnesty's Kate Schutze says bigger, wealthier and high-polluting countries like New Zealand should open up migration pathways for residents of the small nations vulnerable to climate change.
The responsibility here across the region falls largely to the bigger countries that have the capacity and the resources to deal with this. And I think this argument about whether Aotearoa New Zealand could accommodate or afford these people, we have to bear in mind that we're talking small island nations, we're talking small populations as well, and the threat of rising sea levels is an existential threat to the very existence of people in these territories.
Her colleague Nicola Delvino says New Zealand only needs to look to its bigger neighbour, Australia, for an example of what's possible with its recently instituted Falapili visas for Tuvalu's citizens.
It shows that it is possible, if there is political will, to provide people from Tuvalu and others impacted by the climate crisis with the migration pathway. It is a pathway that also allow people to migrate, but not to break ties with their culture, because it allows people to go back and forth without losing their status in Australia. And one positive aspect is definitely that it does not discriminate on the basis of disability or age.
And that was Amnesty International researcher Nicola Delvino ending that report from the ABC's Liam Fox. You're listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka, bringing you up to date with all the top stories from across the Pacific region. Dozens of candidates vying for a spot in Tonga's 26-seat parliament have registered for the national election. As potential leaders, they'll have to address an array of problems, from a methamphetamine epidemic to an under-resourced civil service and a struggling healthcare system. The ABC's Finau Funua visited the Election Commission office in Nuku'alofa, where he spoke to various candidates.
I'm standing outside the Elections Commission office in Nuku'alofa. There's a tent with a whole bunch of people sitting under it. They're waiting for the office to open so they can go in and register to run as a candidate in the Tonga national elections, which take place next month, November 20th. That's the day when the ballot box opens for the public. I'm going to go over and have a chat with some of them. The question I'm going to pose is, what do they think is the most urgent challenge for Tonga to resolve?
Koiha ai fo i mea o ku ke pehe o ku tonu ke resolve i he wawe taha.
O fie mao ha tokanga whakawawe ki ai.
There's an urgent need to address this issue, and the issue is the drugs, because it's causing a lot of problems. It's impacting families, from the children to the grandparents. This is a small country, so why shouldn't we be able to deal with this issue? We have to do something about the legislation, and we all have to work together.
I think we better to solve the way how we can control the drugs here in Tonga. And not only that, the salary for the government staff.
Well, there are a lot of problems. As you know, every nation has its own challenges. I mean, I've just stepped out from a role from tourism as CEO of Ministry of Tourism, so, I mean, I can talk of the issues of tourism's facing as one of the priority sectors in this nation. Also on the employment side and social issues at the moment.
One notable candidate who I spoke to was Viliami Takao. He's the former tourism CEO for Tonga, and he's been advocating very strongly for a better health system. Earlier this year, he went viral on social media when he made a public call for government to address Tonga's stretched health system. And this followed the passing of his wife last year. His wife died in hospital, and he says that could have been avoided.
I lost my wife to our health system, so I can speak on that side. I think I'm one of the few can speak that I've experienced it. Hats off to our health workers. A lot of challenges there. I mean, health is one of them, and one of those real sensitive areas for families there.
The most notable candidate I spoke to, however, is the former Prime Minister Siyasi Sovaleni Huakavamiliku. He resigned as Prime Minister just a little more than a year ago, and he resigned in Parliament when a vote for a motion of no confidence against him was approved. The reason given by those who initiated the motion were concerns about government overspending, the poor state of Tonga's national airline. However, many believe this motion was influenced by the monarchy. Just weeks before his resignation, Huakavamiliku got into a public dispute with King Tubo VI. The king was unhappy with a ministerial appointment. Now, Huakavamiliku is expected to win his constituency easily. He's expected to get back into parliament. The question is, can he become prime minister again? In order for that to happen, he's going to need new faces in parliament who are supportive of him.
My focus is basically to be elected by Tuan Daptol, the number three constituency. That's my number one priority. Right now, that's my focus. I'm very happy for all the support, but at the end of the day, I still actually have to do the groundwork and actually talk to the people, tell them what I intend to do, what my plans are, because, I mean, end of the day, it's something that they should know. They should know what they're voting for and who they're voting for.
Is this personal for you? Just
For me, I believe I can still help. I can still make a difference. That's why I'm sitting here.
What do you think of the current government?
I think moving forward, representatives need to work together, whatever vision or differences and so forth. But for the overall good of Tonga, I think we need to make amends and come together and work for the betterment of Tonga.
And that was former Tonga Prime Minister Siyasi Sovaleni, and he'll be running for re-election in Tonga's parliament next month. And that report from the ABC's Finau Funua. Any Fijian rugby players considering signing up for the proposed Global League R360 will be barred from representing the country. The Fiji Rugby Union has fallen in line with the world's leading rugby nations, including Australia and New Zealand, by imposing a blanket ban. It's a move which has prompted leading figures in the game to suggest that R360 is already dead in the water. And with confirmation of Tier 1 status imminent, the Fiji Rugby Union's chair, John Sanday, says the union needs all their best players on board. But if R360 can demonstrate that none would be tied down, he says his board may be willing to reconsider its blanket ban.
We don't have the details. We have not met R360. So, you know, based on the information that we have, that's where we are. But we're not saying that our players should never sign. It's up to them. They can sign if they want. But we need to preserve the integrity of the international test for us. And if they make themselves available during the international windows, we need to sit down and discuss. But as of now, we don't have that information.
I'm wondering then, based on what you said, that perhaps yourselves and other nations are jumping the gun here. Maybe you need more information before making these decisions?
As we speak, the information available, that's our position. Until we get more clarification and we see how it all stacks up in relation to our test matches that are coming up over the next few years, then we will make a decision that fits that. But we don't want to prevent players from pursuing their commercial interest. That's really their entitlement. We can encourage them. But for us, we want to have our best players available for our test matches lined up for the next 5 years.
So just to confirm, your decision is not cut and dried?
Well, I have not met with the R360, and none of our directors have, so we hold that position. Until that information set is renewed, where R360 sees how it can fit with us, we'll consider.
It could prove to be quite a dilemma, I would think, for a young player to resolve, because the suggestion is there will be big money involved in this tournament, but certainly as far as Fiji is concerned, we're awaiting confirmation of Tier 1 status. You're a team on the move, so for a player to turn his back on playing international rugby for Fiji, that would be a huge decision.
It's every young man's dream in Fiji to wear the white jersey. And, you know, the financial rewards for that is improving considerably. So, you know, as we line up more test matches and we get better revenues, that can only get better. We may not be able to match whatever is being offered out there. it's still a lucrative package. And much more important than the financial rewards is the pride for the family, the pride for the village, the pride for the country. For one of us to wear the white jersey and play international test matches and also be rewarded reasonably well is plenty. But it is a dilemma. We have to make sure we draw the line where our interests are, and we want to protect that.
That was John Sande, a former Flying Fijian himself and now chair of Fiji's Rugby Union, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Richard Hewitt. Thank you for listening. That's the wrap for Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka, and join us again same time, same place next week for more news and views from across the Pacific region.